We rise for the gospel. The Holy Gospel, according to Luke, the 20th chapter. Then some Sadducees who say that people will not rise from death came to Jesus and said, "Teacher, Moses wrote this law for us. If a man dies and leaves a wife but no children, that man's brother must marry the widow so that they can have children who will be considered the dead man's children. Once there were seven brothers. The oldest got married and died without having children, so the second one married the woman, and then the third. The same thing happened to all seven. They died without having children. Last of all, the woman died. Now on the day when the dead rise to life, whose wife will she be? All seven of them have married her." And Jesus answered them, "The men and women in this age marry, but the men and women who are worthy to rise from death and live in the age to come will not then marry. They will be like angels and cannot die. They are like the children of God, or they are the children of God because they have risen from death. And Moses clearly proves that the dead are raised to life. In the passage about the burning bush, he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is the God of the living, not of the dead. For to God all are alive." The Gospel of the Lord. So, in today's Gospel lesson, we have probably one of the most frequent occurrences you'll ever have in the church. People are arguing. And that's because people are people wherever they go. I like to imagine, and I don't know that I'm imagining, I think it's actually the case, that this is part of a much longer conversation that Jesus was having, you know, not just with the Sadducees, but it's part of the normal kind of arguing back and forth that we all do about our faith. You know, in the grand scheme of things, within the entire church, you know, there's the arguments that different denominations have about how Jesus works and how faith works and how salvation works. You know, there are the arguments about, well, do we work for our faith, or do we believe for our faith, or is salvation something we can lose? Or I wonder sometimes whether it's something we can gain too. You know, it's because it's an act of God. Is it something that we really have any effect over? Or is it something that God does? I don't know. There's a lot that I don't know, right? And I could spend a long time talking about all the things that I don't know. And so I know that even not just among denominations, but within our own denomination, we have our arguments, you know. We've had, you know, what a lot of pastors will refer to as the recent unpleasantness of 2009, where everyone was angry about everything for a while. We have an argument about whether or not it's reasonable to talk about sanctuary. We have arguments about things that are hot cultural issues that sometimes all of us wish people would just leave alone, but also we recognize that it's an important part of how we understand the value of being a Christian in our culture, that somehow we have to talk about these things, but we know we're not going to agree. You know, down to some of the most mundane arguments that we get in. I joke about the color of the carpet a lot, and I notice that y'all have avoided this by not having, like, any carpet in this building. I congratulate you. But even though it seems like a silly argument, when you're in the middle of it, and it's not that you're trying to tear the church down, but you're trying to find some way to administer the business of the congregation, to be able to do worship the right way, to be able to do all of these things in a way that build up church and build up the congregation and build up the community, and then two people have really passionate differing ideas about how to do that. You know, those arguments aren't just because we like to be argumentative all the time, but they're really because we have this deep passion, because we believe this is something important. And if it's important, sometimes it's worth arguing over. And, you know, they're no different in Jesus' time than we are now. You know, they had those theological arguments, they had those disagreements that were not just the ones that they worried about in the moment. But they were the ones that ran bone deep in their culture. And so if you look in your Cranberry book at some point, you'll find a section that says creeds. There's an Apostles' Creed and a Nicene Creed, and I know we don't use either of those in this service, but they're still part of what we believe as people who follow Jesus. Both of those came out of a council that was convened actually by the Roman government, because Christians were arguing bitterly and it was becoming problematic for the peace in the countryside, you know. And they all talk about all these different things that we agree to believe as Christians. And, you know, there's the three articles: I believe in God the Father, and then I believe in God the Son, and then the shortest one, I believe in the Holy Spirit, because nobody quite knows what to do with the Spirit. And then you have those other ones: we believe in the Holy Catholic Church, we believe in the forgiveness of sins, and then this one that really applies to today: we believe in the resurrection of the body. And that one, you know, you want to talk about something that I have trouble understanding? That one gets really complicated, because I know kind of the traditional belief that Lutherans ascribe to is that, you know, at some point, God decides that the dead are raised. We argue about whether it's some of the dead. We argue about whether it's all of the dead. We believe that there is a physical resurrection. So somehow, the flesh and blood that we have is flesh and blood that we will have at the time of the resurrection. What's that look like? Do we have some glorified body that's all shiny and new and bright and whatever? I don't know. Or do we, you know, if I live to be 80, will I come back as 80? Or would I come back as I might prefer to be at like 22, 23 when I was a lot, you know, even now at 42, I'm not old, but I certainly don't have the kind of stamina and resilience that I had at 23, right? That was just a fun age. Will we be like Jesus and maintain the wounds that we had when we died? You know, there's no place in our faith that talks about, you know, even the ascended Jesus being healed of those wounds, the holes in his hands, the hole in his side. And the pictures of the risen Jesus, that not pictures, but art that we have of the risen Jesus at any point, always shows the holes in his hands as a sign that what Jesus did, what God does through the death and resurrection of Jesus, is something that's permanent. But there's also this strong sense in our culture that, you know, and I joke about it, and I have a couple times, you know, the some glad morning when this life is over and we're floating on a cloud somewhere, me and Jesus playing a harp together. And I, you know, there's that sense in the culture that somehow, even though we talk about the resurrection, we don't exactly know what to do with that or categorize it, because it's just so foreign to our experience. So if we still have all these questions, if we still have all these arguments, and these arguments are as relevant today as they've always been, then it makes a lot of sense that people in the temple, you know, among the Jewish community, were arguing about all of these same things, especially because our faith is descended from this faith, right? So the Sadducees were people who I don't think didn't believe that anything happened after you die. I don't think they were annihilationists who just believe when you die, you die. I think they were more of the floating on the cloud somewhere and the spiritual whatever. Because really at this point, even though they were Romans, the culture was really Greek. And the Greek culture had this real idea that there is a separation between the flesh and the spirit. Flesh is bad, spirit good. So if good people are raised, then they have to get rid of this bad flesh, and then they're all spirit people. And so it makes sense that a religious culture that came up in the Greek culture where this is important would have this argument and have this idea in the church that there is something different that happens than what we experience now. And so they do what people always do. They tried to catch Jesus. And I think we tried to catch Jesus too. We've all asked Jesus unfair questions, I think, probably. We've all asked God questions that were designed to catch God. I saw a video somewhere on the internet recently where someone walked out with a shovel and said, "Strike me down, Zeus, I dare you," and then lightning struck. Now what do we do with that? Not sure. But, you know, we all have those moments where we say, you know, "God, if you're really there, then," and then we have our own conditions. Say something. Show me something. You know, do something. And the wonderful part of that, if something does happen, is, holy cow, maybe this is the confirmation that I need. The challenging part of this, if something does happen, is if we're not in a position that we're ready to hear it and accept it and do something about it. It would not matter if God were to physically manifest here right now and say, your carpet should be green, we would say, wow, that was a really striking coincidence. What should we do now? It just is the way we are. So when Jesus is caught in this logical argument, and we also have to acknowledge that, you know, in this culture where they're talking about this Levitical marriage, which is one of the versions of biblical marriage there is, the women were largely considered to be property. And so if a woman didn't have children by the husband, this is why the brother would then marry the woman and they would try to have children together that would then legally belong to the deceased husband. Got to have somebody to pass the property on to. Got to have some way to continue the family line. You know, when you think about it, this is really pretty morbid. Can you imagine trying to do that in today's culture? That would be just crazy to us, right? So we have this question, you know, if a man marries a wife and he dies, and then she marries his brother and he dies, and it goes on, and all seven of them marry and die, and she survives, and that poor woman, by the way, anyone who has to figure out, I feel bad for my wife most of the time having to live with me. I can't imagine her having to try to figure out how to live with somebody else, especially someone related to me, because we're all stubborn in my family. You know, but that goes right with the importance of this question. You know, how does the resurrection work? If we believe this, there must be something that we can know about it. If we're going to profess it, there must be a way to talk about it rationally. If we're going to find a way for this to be true, how can we understand it in a way that makes sense in the world that we live in? And so I think Jesus in some ways is able to dodge the question just a little bit by saying, well, you know, in the resurrection, we're just not going to get married. As a pastor, sometimes we say things like that have deep sounding authority, but it's just because we're not ready to deal with the question yet. Now, Jesus has different knowledge than what I have, and so it's possible and probable that Jesus is giving actual doctrine. In the resurrection, we won't marry. We'll be like the angels because we're children of God. And that solves the whole issue. But I don't know that it actually makes me feel any more comfortable, because it still leaves wide open the biggest questions of my faith that I have, which is, well, what really happens? And when we live in a world and in a faith where we're not going to get definite answers, then, you know, how do we deal with that in a world that demands answers? And I can let us off the hook a little bit. As Lutherans, one of my favorite things about being a Lutheran is we tend to be a tradition and a faith that lives not in either or, we live in both and. And so when you hear things that Luther said, like we are simultaneously saint and sinner, those two things seem pretty mutually exclusive, right? How can I be both someone who's a saint and someone who's actively a sinner? Because saints are supposed to be perfect people. Now, you will remember from last week on All Saints Sunday, we said that saints aren't necessarily perfect. Being a saint means somebody in whom God is working through the waters of baptism. Being a saint is being someone who is a part of the kingdom of God, not because we're particularly good, but because God is present in us and calling us to live a new life, right? So we can say that we are both saint and sinner and be able to live in that tension. And it allows me to do something as someone who has always had challenges because I am so curious and I do want answers, but it helps me to live in the mystery and the disappointment of not having answers. When I say I believe in the resurrection from the dead, I can say it authentically because I don't have to understand how it works. I can give that one up to God. I can trust and rest in the idea that I don't have to know. And as frustrating as I find that, because I do like to know, I also find it to be freeing to be able to say, well, it's just something that's above my pay grade. Because it allows me to live in a space that lets me remain human, lets me remain real, that lets me not have to turn off my brain in order to have faith and in order to function in the church and in the world, but it allows me to be able to be someone who continues to wrestle with the realities of our belief and the way we experience the world to work. So this isn't, I apologize, a sermon that's like, here's a neat little bow and now you can walk out of here and feel really good because you have an answer. This is just part of our homework as people who believe in Jesus. This is, you know, there are a lot of things we're not going to know, that we're going to wrestle with, that we're going to struggle with. There are going to be answers that we want, and we're willing to ask God all the gotcha questions that we can come up with, because, you know, there are just moments where those answers feel so good. And we are in a faith where we're not seeking answers as much as we're seeking relationship, and relationship is always an open-ended question. This week is, as you wrestle with those questions and you wrestle with the different ways that you engage faith that allows you both to have it, but also for you to feel like a real human being who, you know, lives in a real world, I'd like to invite you, in a similar way that I invited the children to ponder the love of God, I'd like to invite you in your prayer to take some time and pray about the things that you find to be mysterious or confusing or frustrating about our faith. Not prayers for answers, but prayers that understand that Jesus spoke in parables not because he wanted to confuse us, but because sometimes getting something that is called an answer is even more confusing than mystery. So I think an example of this prayer might be, you know, God, help me to hear what you're saying in the way that you're saying it rather than in the way I want it. There are lots of ways you can pray this prayer. But wrestle this week with the things you don't understand and appreciate the fact that we have a God who loves us whether we understand or not, and who we can trust to fulfill promises, those promises of love and welcome and belonging. Amen.